Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Monday, January 10th, 2022. I'm Maggie Lake, here today with Alfonso Pacatiello, the author of The Macro Compass and Real Vision's Weston Nakamura. This is shaping up to be a volatile week, so we decided to pull in not one, but two of our best thinkers to help us all make sense of what is going on. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, Maggie.
I'm so happy you're here today because it was a rough Monday, especially if you were long risk assets. Tech stocks continued their march lower. The yield on the 10-year got as high as 1.8%, and Bitcoin briefly dipped below 40,000. Before we jump in, a short time ago, Real Vision founder Raul Powell shared his thoughts on some of the technicals that he thinks are contributing to the move in crypto. Let's have a listen.
Well, interestingly, as you know, I thought that we were going to see a large rally in crypto in the back end of the year. That would have been playing out the historical patterns from 2013 or 2017, but it didn't happen. That took me by surprise. And that made me sit down and look at the market and figure out, okay, what the hell is going on here? Why didn't it do it? Is this good news or bad news or indifferent? What is it? So I broke apart the market, and I'm going to go through some of the charts in a minute. And I realized that the network growth had slowed down significantly. You see, what had happened is a huge amount of retail had come in in 2020. Then in 2021, we started off the year with a lot of institutions coming in, allocating capital. And then what happened was we started to see the rise of inflation. As inflation picked up, wages didn't pick up as fast. And the marginal buyer of crypto, the marginal investor, the retail investor, was kind of sidelined. And so that kept the network growth slower. Then we saw China, and the Chinese were essentially banning crypto, and the number of active wallet addresses collapsed. So what you'd taken is an all-time high in wallet addresses had suddenly fallen by about a third as these Chinese participants had left the marketplace. And the network has yet to adapt because it hasn't gone back to a new all-time high. And I'll show you some charts on that in a bit. So it's been one of these sideways years. Now, we've not really ever had one in crypto like this. Now, ETH has been more bullishly biased, and that's been driven by the buybacks of the burning of tokens by the 1559 changes that took place during the year, and that has kept it outperforming. We've seen things like Solana, AVAX, Terra also doing similarly because they're earlier in the network. As people moved away from Ethereum, which was expensive, the NFTs and stuff like that, where there's more high-frequency volume, they moved to these other protocols. The other protocols started exploding in price because the network is being used, i.e. Metcalfe's law valuation. And in addition, many of these have got burning too.
Interesting stuff. Just a little snippet there of Raul's outlook. For the full interview, you could check it out on Real Vision Pro tier. Raul brings up a really interesting point, though, that impact of the retail investor. We know there were big drivers on the upside, both in crypto, but also in some of the big tech names, you know, that we saw piling into those trades, really pushing, especially the Nasdaq higher. What do you think's going through their mind now? What happens to that market dynamic now that we're in this potentially more volatile, higher interest rate environment?
So, Maggie, I think the main message I want to pass across is that people are waking up to the fact that the Fed is going to tighten. I mean, literally, they are going to tighten. If you ask people around 3 months ago, you know, there were doubts, maybe a couple of hikes, maybe a slow tapering. Now we're talking about four hikes. That's Goldman Sachs coming out today with a note talking about four hikes. It's pretty much consensus. But we're also talking about quantitative tightening at this point. So we went, you know, all the way from QE to tapering, which is slowing down the pace of increase of the balance sheet, to quantitative tightening, which is quite a thing. It means literally reducing the balance sheet. And, you know, as the average investor out there gets accustomed to that, and also interest rates start to reprice higher, and I should add, real interest rates start to reprice higher. valuations in the most high beta sort of assets out there start to matter a lot, because your incremental increase in risk-free real interest rates basically allows you to place money in a cash, short-term, risk-free alternative at a lesser punitive rate. And therefore, valuations that are always a relative matter tend to get hit. And I guess that's just what's happening here. If you look at asset classes performance across the board, it's the high beta stuff, the stuff that is really sensitive to a Federal Reserve interest rate cycle, very sensitive to real interest rates. That's the one which is getting hit the most here.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out, right? We have a class of investors who've never really seen this before. I mean, it has been a long time since we've been in this environment, and it's a big switch very quickly. I mean, Weston, how is this playing out internationally, especially now that we have a backdrop where we may have central banks moving at different speeds?
Yeah. Well, just to pick up on what you just said, that we've never seen a class of, you know, investors who've seen higher rates before. This reminds me so much. This is exactly what people say about my generation of millennials now sitting on trading desks, some of them now becoming managing directors and all that. You've never seen what a not QE market looks like. Well, you've never seen a non like bull market in rates either. So let's all just calm down about that. But onto the international thing. Yeah. So first of all, last week or before the new year started, so basically at the very end of December, I had a kind of solo RVDB. And I pointed out basically all of these different regions and their market holidays and why that's important. Because absent like, you know, certain, regions and players, markets, it's going to affect markets. And I specifically pointed out that the absence of Japan for the, you know, when everyone comes back in January, Japan's still going to be out. Japan's a major buyer of U.S. treasuries. So you might see, yield spike on that Monday. Well, they did. Then when markets reopened for Japan, they leveled off for that time being. They've obviously spiked since then. But what I said was like, let's not, you know, those sort of moves, let's not attribute all of that strictly to like inflation or the whatever latest Omicron headline is or whatever that may be. Today, Japan was closed again. So you are absent of the largest, foreign creditor in U.S. treasuries, once again, in the markets, and you saw a significant move in yields. Would yields have moved the same way if Japan had been open? Who knows? But you are missing, you are absent a large buyer, and I'm sure that contributed as well. And at the end of the day, like, treasuries are just very much so just like any other asset. It's a FOMO thing, right? Like, the Japanese could also get caught up in selling because others are selling, or buying because others are buying, and not necessarily some, sort of fundamental thing. Everyone's kind of looking, waiting to pull the trigger. So I think that generally, though, the eyes are going to be on, the Powell confirmation in the Senate or in Congress and on CPI that are both coming at the same time. And I don't think that there's a lot of people that are either in their offices or actually putting capital to work before ahead of that. Heavy volumes on the equity side, but I don't think that there's too much on the rate side.
Right. Right. And that we do have these two major events coming this week. We have a lot of questions coming in already. Keep putting them in. We're going to get to them. But Alf, this is such a big change in thinking. And Weston, absolutely right to point out the millennial thing. I often wonder if the more experience you have, the more it colors what you think is going to happen, because you're already running the end game instead of just sort of, watching the developments unfold. But Alf, is the market correctly pricing in what's happening with the Fed? Have they gotten too aggressive about this call?
So I just tweeted something before the Real Vision Daily Briefing, which basically said, Jamie Dimon came out and said the Fed needs to hike 25 times. He says it's every time, rates need to be 5%, 10%, whatever. So he has come out publicly. There will be many more hikes than four this year. Jeff Gundlach has come out saying that, you need to be short the bond market. Goldman Sachs came out with four hikes and accelerated schedule for quantitative tightening. Every strategist I know on the street, which I still talk to, is telling me that you need to be bearish rates. real interest rates have already sold off 40 basis points since the beginning of the year, which maybe doesn't sound too much, but it's a quite large move in only 10 days. I mean, in standard deviation terms, it's pretty large. It's a large move. So you see all of that, and you see that the front end of the euro-dollar curve is pricing about 3.5 hikes from the Fed this year, Maggie. So, you know, it's basically almost fully pricing in 4 hikes, which seems to be a reasonable amount the Fed can pull off this year. And everybody out there is already talking about quantitative tightening. So as you and I are talking about it in Weston, then it probably means that some of it, it's already priced in as well. So I just said, maybe it's time to lean long tactically bonds out here, but there will be different dynamics out there that impact different parts of the bond curve, which are also very important for different equity markets or for crypto. So if we look at the front end of the bond market, is the euro dollar market wrong in pricing 3.5 hikes this year? I said it before and I will repeat it again. The Fed will tighten. They're looking at CPI at 7%, which will come down, but it will be still way above their mandate. They're looking at a very tight labor market. We have seen the last labor report, and participation rate doesn't pick up. The pie of labor supply is not expanding, but the job openings are still there because the economy is still relatively strong. As a result, you get a pretty tight labor market. They're looking at November 2022 midterm elections, and there undoubtedly is some political pressure to make sure that real wages, as Raul pointed out in his clip, real wages are negative. They need to turn up again to make sure that, you know, the consumer is able to effectively be the engine of the next growth phase, cyclical growth phase. In order to do that, you need to control inflation first. And also the risk reward for the Fed here not to act is pretty bad, if you ask me. So they will tighten, which means probably the front end of the bond market is correctly assessing the possibilities here. But the long end of the bond market is telling us that, you know, this is quite, it's going to be a tightening that is going to cost something to the long-term future growth, basically. So the long end of the bond market is having a very hard time in pricing a regime change. I have one of the charts here, chart number 3 for this Real Vision Daily Briefing, that shows the very clear trend 30-year bond yields have been in America for the last, I think it's 30 years on the chart, probably, even longer, 35 years. Since 1987, 30-year bond yields have dropped from 9% to where they are now, 2%. And you can see this very clear linear trend line that I depicted in orange at the Macro Compass newsletter that I write. And you can see I pointed out sometimes the regime changes that we heard throughout the last 35 years. So there's a very clear channel, and then 30-year bond yields tend to trade upswings and downswings around this channel. But the trend line is very clear, and it's downward trending. And the last regime changes we have listened to were in 2010, where everybody told me that QE was inflationary and therefore bond yields had to go up. That was the regime change. Of course, nothing happened there. 2013, we had taper tantrum. That was another regime change. Well, nothing happened again. And in 2018, everybody thought, Jamie Dimon included, that 30-year bond yields should have been 6%. They went to 3%, and of course, they followed back to the trend line. So is this a regime change? No, it's not. Is this a moment where the bond market, especially at the front end, can cyclically reprice higher? Yes, it is, because the Federal Reserve will tighten.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, Homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
And I think, Alf, reminding us of the shorter term situation against the longer, more structural term story is so important. I think, Weston, the question that keeps coming up now is, can Bitcoin perform, recover in a rising interest rate environment, even if it's short term? Is a hawkish Fed bad for Bitcoin valuation? What are you looking at when you look at the Bitcoin chart here?
I certainly don't look at FOMC expectations. and the reason why is because I don't think that Bitcoin traders are particularly concerned with that either way. I don't think that. It really is just based on flows, buys and sells, that aren't necessarily attached to something like inflation. Of course, there are people that. So what happens is that people that have a certain narrative, a reason for why they are long Bitcoin, why they hold it. It could be any number of reasons. And then when the price actually does goes in the direction that you want it to, it validates your whatever your insert the blank reason is. For me, the story for Bitcoin for Q4, right, is basically it revolves around this ETF launch from BITO in the US. So basically, if you look at it from October, right, and I talked about this with Jim Bianco and Ash towards the end of the year, but this is we're at a very critical level right now. And the reason is because around this BTC USD 40,000-ish level, and this is not exact or anything like that, but that's around the point where you start this October rally up to these sort of new highs, and then it's basically right back down to this break-even level. So right now, anyone who was long from there, if they just held on, they're now looking at potentially having a negative P&L. So what happened was you have these CME futures. Bitcoin futures back ETF, excuse me. So if you look at this second chart, you see this CFTC COT data. This is a chart of basically Bitcoin futures and the launch of ProShares ETF. And you could see that there was this run up right before, leading into it. That was literally, ProShares and the rest of them. Getting their ETF literally in order, and as well as front running speculators and all that kind of thing. And then it launched, and then you have a lot of open interest open at that point. This whole rally is kind of artificial in my mind, because this is all just kind of mechanical in order to make this ETF and for inflows and share creations and all that kind of thing. And then the next chart you'll see this positioning on CFTC. This is open interest from the peak in November, and you can see open interest is down 40%. So in CME futures. And the next chart, you can see this is the positioning of the dealer community, which is basically an inverse reflection of the invest community. And you can see open interest basically spikes and then falls alongside the price. Next chart. This is the asset management community who got in kind of late at the peak, and they are now currently very long CME futures. You can see the percentage of open interest is now, they went from single digits to now a third of open interest as asset managers. They're long throughout this whole decline, and they're starting to shed their positions. Next chart and this is the ETF itself. This is BITO. This is their holdings. And what I've circled here is both the daily holdings as of yesterday and the CME's open interest position for January and February contracts. This is what the two contracts that they hold. They basically hold about half of open interest. This one ETF holds about half of open interest in Bitcoin. So if BITO, the ETF, holds half of the open interest of CME Bitcoin, and CME Bitcoin was responsible for that rally from the beginning of October to into November and then down again. Well, then you really need to look at this ETF. If this is kind of ground zero, So that's how I'm looking at it. It's just kind of a mechanical thing. It's just a launch, and it got a lot of, you know, sort of immediate initial inflows, you know, fastest on record. Mm-hmm. And now it's just, you know, it's that. It's not really a story about inflation or anything like that. It's just a flows-driven story, and this is the channel of flows that I've basically seen.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, I think people, when they were looking at that chart and the decline, they were saying, oh, it trades like a risk asset. That's why they're making the link with inflation. You're saying forget the pyramid part. Just look at the 40 part. All of that was fictional or flow driven based on the launch of the ETF. Now watch that 40 level, because that's where it would have been trading. And that's what we need to pay attention to now to get a sense of where it's going forward. Is that a fair summary of what you just said?
You said it better than I did. Yes. So this is basically, this is going to either be a floor. This is, you know, this could very well be bottom tick currently for 2022. I mean, who knows, right? But, or it can be, should it break clean, you can get significant downside, but you're always going to get, like, you know, buyers coming in, but you know, there's a lot of people who are still sitting on profits that would like to take those profits, that are happy to.
So. Right. I think on both on the macro picture and on Bitcoin, so helpful to have that perspective. So let's dive in a little bit, and people definitely asking very specific strategy questions, because we are at this point where people are trying to figure out what to do with their portfolios. You know, either one, jump in. I think Weston, this might be one for you, but Alf, certainly feel free to jump in as well. Question from Marshall on the exchange. Should I move my stack into Tether and buy back in later? I have already lost all my gains plus 10%.
I don't know, because I'm not you. Only you can make that decision. So I don't know.
It's sort of this inflection point, isn't it, for both of you, though, that if people are you know, if they rode this down and they're underwater, you know, what do you do in that perspective, regardless of the underlying asset? You know, that you have to understand your risk profile, I guess, right?
I would just say to Marshall, I think this was his name.
Yeah.
If the volatility swings and the drawdowns are more than you can stomach, then probably the sizing of your position was too large in the first place. Then in general, when that is the case, not necessarily your case, I don't know, but when that is the case, then you should just adjust, you know, I would just adjust my position back to my risk appetite. And that's always an assessment that people need to do before entering a trade. That's one. And then, the second one, more tactically, I myself at the Macro Compass have been tactically short Bitcoin for macro reasons. So Weston is talking about flows that are very relevant. Of course, they move the market short term. I also think there is a relatively bearish macro constellation for Bitcoin here. It has played already. It's down 10% year to date. Would I reopen a short position here? I'm not that sure. I'm more inclined to actually take profits on my shorts when it comes to a tactical assessment of Bitcoin positioning.
Weston, we have a question related to your update on the Turkey fiasco. This is from RAR and Ewan Gray, two different people, RAR from YouTube, Ewan from RV site. I'm interested in your update on the Turkey fiasco and how or if it might spill over into the EU euro market. Lira update from Weston would be great. And I'm interested to hear both of these, because when we see selling and volatility in markets, you know, what we really always want to look for is the unexpected happening or any kind of spillover in any kind of emerging market situation that may be dealing with its own fundamentals, but this will put added pressure on situations. Weston, I know you've been all over those stories. Anything that you want to update us on?
The Lira, I will be putting out an update video. There are so many headlines that basically are coming out. Before I speak out of pure ignorance as opposed to just, you know, my usual like 50% ignorance. I don't want to comment too much, but what I will say is that, clearly this Erdogan, rolling out of this policy, is not being, you know, accepted with open arms by the Turkish people. You have dollar lira now back up at 14, somewhere around there. The volatility has come down a little bit, the realized volatility, but it's still, you're still looking at a realized volatility that's that, you know, one that's still, you know, on par with Bitcoin, given even with the volatility of recent Bitcoin. So this is, like I said, like in terms of where, like the directional sort of trade for like the lira itself, or sort of a spillover effect from, you know, EU banking and all that. That's all kind of, you know, we'll have to see how the, you know, we'll mostly have to see how the people on the ground in Turkey, whether or not they adopt this, this new sort of, I don't want to call it scheme, this policy for depositors, you know, to protect them from FX losses and all that. So we'll have to see about that. But what I will say is that, If you look at basically the lira as, you know, from somebody on the ground in Turkey, you know, lira volatility at like 100 vol or 80 vol or, you know, realized vol, that is not okay. That is completely unacceptable for your currency to move that way. And it's going to continue to cause, as I said in my video, it's going to continue to cause this like domestic social unrest. And that's very dangerous because it's going to, you know, you combine that with like Erdogan, who is up for re-election. And if he can't fix the situation on the ground in the, you know, in the economy, and people are getting hit on a, you know, feeling it on a day-to-day basis, he's going to create some sort of geopolitical external volatility that's going to spill over into commodity and, you know, risk asset volatility globally. Especially with like Russia, NetGas, Ukraine, all that, like, you know, all mixed in. And so I think that there's significant geopolitical volatility risk associated with the lira. And that in itself is not good for financial markets.
Yeah. And why so many of our viewers have been watching your thread on that so closely.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
513 Whiskey declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Alf, we have a question from Goncalo on the exchange. Hi, 4 months ago, Alf turned bullish tech and bonds and said to short cyclicals. This is, again, 4 months ago. So the market went completely against his trade. Could he comment on whether he still thinks that's the correct current trade? Doesn't a liquidity event, if the Fed tightens too much, also affect tech? How does he manage all these variables?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've been long tech and short Russell in 2021 for a while. This actually worked pretty well. Nasdaq overperformed Russell by 20% during that year. I am still, by the way, in my asset allocation, which is very transparent. It's available at the Macro Compass. There is no hiding. The latest update was still long Nasdaq, which is true, and it's working against me. So the way I look at that is I am long, let's say, the idea was to be long quality tech. I chose Nasdaq in that asset allocation box to simplify, let's say, and to just choose a ticker for people to let them understand what I was looking at. They also remarked the fact that I was net short the equity market. Against being long Nasdaq, I was short the Russell, short China, short Brazilian equities. So if you just combine the overall equity positioning was slightly net short, and the Nasdaq leg is not working well, but this is a multi-leg trade. So it's not one trade, but it's, you know, more together, there are more legs to this trade. In general, if I go with one trade out, one investment idea out, not taken in the context of asset allocation, but just literally as a tactical investment idea, and I'm wrong, you'll just see me saying that, I'm just going to stop out because as everybody else out there, I will be right, hopefully 55 to 60% of the times, I'll be wrong 45 to 40% of the times. When I'm wrong, I will just stop out. I mean, limiting your downside risks is as important in order to make money at the end of the year. And I'm not a guru. I'm just one of you guys.
Yeah, well said. And that's, again, to bring up your point earlier to Marshall, understanding your risk profile and making sure that you are trading appropriate to that. Weston, I know you've been watching, back to the issue of big tech, I know you've been watching the situation in Taiwan. Why is that important? Why are you paying close attention to that corner of the world?
Yeah, so there's no situation yet, and they're just maybe. So I put out a video recently, basically because, so everyone's talking about, yeah, there's a sell-off in NASDAQ. You don't need me to tell you that. So what I've basically I'm looking at is, if you look at the TAIEX index, the Taiwan stock market, so going into this year, it's basically hitting, record highs, just like many other indices. However, it's being driven by almost purely by domestic levered margin retail in Taiwan. Something like 12 million accounts that are that have like an average gain of almost a million Taiwan dollars, or like 35,000 USD, which is, I think, is not bad for an average account. But in 2021 alone. So, but if you recall, in May of 2021, there was this kind of this one day, like 8% limit down flash crash. Well, not a flash crash, but a crash in the Taiwan stock market that led to another like 5% downside immediately thereafter, later that day, on the NASDAQ. And that was largely due to, there's a whole bunch of reasons for what may have triggered it, COVID risk or COVID case number one in Taiwan. Either way, buy and sell orders are what move markets. And what happened that day was that margin calls started to just, cascade. And you just got this this forced unwind of retail traders in Taiwan. Well, that same exact sort of scenario, or a very similar setup, is happening right now, in which Taiwan can be this sort of safe haven long for tech. If you're getting out of U.S. tech right now and you need tech exposure, or you need semiconductor exposure, being long Taiwan is a way to play it. And you can see Taiwan has been outperforming the NASDAQ year to date and all that kind of thing. But you have to be very careful because of how much margin leverage there is currently in that is positioned long in Taiwan. And should you get another one of those sort of sharp 8% limit down declines in Taiwan, or EWT, which is the iShares ETF listed in the U.S., if you get another one of those things, and then you have a sharp sell-off in semiconductors, in the SOX index and the NASDAQ, from here you're now looking at potentially getting into momentum into a bear market territory for NASDAQ. So what I'll say is that if things seem to stabilize, if CPI and Powell's like confirmation and everything goes well, and just make sure you're watching Taiwan as well, and make sure there's no sort of triggering of margin calls and all that can really destroy that market, because then you will have bought the dip way too early and there would be another second leg of selling. So it's just something that I want to throw out there, just so that there's so many risks out there that we don't know about. This is one that we can actually at least be aware of, because the foreigners are very underweight and therefore nobody's probably looking at this. So I just want to throw that out there.
Amazing. Thank you so much for doing that, Weston. And we know that Weston will be watching it for all of us as well. And we'll be sure to include it in his videos on YouTube that he does, which are amazing. And we need that. We need to be paying attention to all of this. And Alf, I want to ask you on the back of that, as we enter again this week where we have these major events, we have Powell, who, let's remember, has been surprising people with what he's been saying, both in testimony, was a big market mover last time. The Fed minutes move the market, which we don't usually see that happening. So there is a lot of potential risk around that. And we have a Wednesday, a CPI number coming out. Against that backdrop, are you concerned at all about risk in the market when everyone's trying to move the same way, or people trying to exit trades at the same time? We've had a lot of conversations on Real Vision about the different nature of the market because of passive investing and, just how things work. It's great on the upside, but what happens on the downside? What happens in a more volatile market? Are you concerned about that at all?
Well, ask me. So till a few months ago, I was managing a 20 billion portfolio. So was moving large flows through the street. what I learned during the COVID pandemic, for example, is that in March 2020, let's say in February 2020, you could move, I could move large sizes in the market and they were absorbed relatively well because both implied and realized volatility was very low. So market makers felt relatively comfortable despite they are pushed by regulation not to warehouse too much risk compared to 10 years ago. In when realized volatility is very low and implied volatility as well, they feel more enticed to warehouse risks on their balance sheet. So they can facilitate large trades from end user clients like I used to be until a couple of months ago. In March 2020, there were a lot of dislocation in the market, a gazillion of those, and most of those actually caused by total absence of liquidity out there. When you were on the other side and you were trying to either get exit liquidity, let's not talk about that. There was no exit liquidity whatsoever. But even worse, when you were trying to catch this dislocation on the other side, there was also no chance to do that because none of these risk takers wanted to take any risk on their balance sheet. At that point, they were absolutely paralyzed. So behavior is very, let's say, convex. So it gets into one direction very quickly and also reverses very quickly. So there is always the risk, or there were larger risks, if you ask me, in 2021 at some point, or 2019, when positions are very crowded and there is very little realized and implied volatility. It's like having a very crowded room, a very crowded party, let's say, in a small room. And then the exit door is always of the same size. And when a couple of people want to get out very early, they feel very stupid because the party can get on for a couple of hours and they miss the nice part of the party. But when the remaining 12 people want to get out at the same time because the music has stopped, the door is always the same size and it can even get very cramped and even smaller than it was before. So always, you know, try to bear that in mind that, you know, procyclical behavior, both on risk on and on risk off, is actually a real thing in markets.
Right. And something we're going to have to be very conscious of and watch very closely over the coming days. I hate to say we squeaked a few extra minutes out, but we have to leave it there. Thanks to both of you. Really great insight, I think, for people to take with them into the week. We had some questions we didn't get to on the Chinese property market from Mark on the RV site, LP on the RV site about oil, copper, and commodities. I want to remind you all, the conversation continues at the exchange. Alf and Weston will be looking there. And Alf will be back tomorrow, especially on the metals and commodities question. Alf's going to be back tomorrow on the Daily Briefing with Tony Greer, who you know is all over that. So we will continue to stay across all of these events for you all week long. Thank you so much for the great conversation. Take care and good luck out there.